We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Leanne Donner, sitting in today for David Inge. This morning we'll talk with someone we all feel like we know already. We spend every Saturday morning with him. He's the host of NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday and an acclaimed author, Scott Simon, whose newest book is Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, in Praise of Adoption. Today's program was pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take calls, but we'll cover a lot of ground, so I hope we'll answer some of your questions anyway. Scott, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure to be with you, Leanne.
We'll talk about your new book in just a moment, but first let's talk about your career. How old were you when you knew you wanted to become a journalist?
Oh, good question. I was always the kid, and without any kind of future vocational thoughts in mind, I was always the kid that put out the class newspaper and later the underground newspaper. I was doing that from, I think, about the sixth or seventh grade, if I'm not mistaken. And where I would put out these one-sheet so-called newspapers where I would actually type it over and over again using carbon paper, labor-intensive. And then I became the editor of the camp newspaper at Camp Indianola in Madison, Wisconsin, where the camp newspaper, this was a mimeographed sheet that came out twice a week. The camp newspaper was called the Totem Pole. And I don't mind telling you, Leanne, we had all kinds of vulgar nicknames for that newspaper, as you can imagine. And I guess it was, you know, it just kind of was, in some ways, a natural progression for me. I understood from an early age, look, like when I was editor of the camp newspaper, I could talk to the camp director more or less whenever I wanted. I could talk to counselors more or less whenever I wanted. I got to, you know, report the scores of games and that sort of thing. And I just thought it was a great way to see the world, as it certainly has been for me.
And did you study journalism in college?
No, I didn't. I had one journalism class at Northwestern, which was called History and Principles of Journalism, but and which you find out that history, by the way, that the journalism has a checkered history and relatively few principles. So it was valuable. But I really, and I tell this to youngsters these days, to students these days, I know that, for example, the University of Illinois there in Champaign has a very distinguished journalism program that Scotty Reston and a lot more distinguished graduates, people who've graduated recently, have been a part of that program. But I do think it's important to not just study journalism, to learn something about the world. And I think some of the best journalists I know have no particular background in journalism. I mean, Nina Totenberg, our legendary Supreme Court correspondent, is the first one to point out that she not only never studied journalism, she never studied the law. And yet she's the preeminent legal reporter in the United States. What she did do was a series of real things. And I think kind of real life exposure, whatever you do, in a way prepares you for journalism.
And how did you find yourself becoming a professional journalist?
Boy, you know, I auditioned for the public television station in Chicago. I'd been working in a neighborhood called Uptown. And they wanted someone who could cover crime in the communities, and I auditioned, and they liked me. And so I was on a show called the Public News Center. The anchor was, I hate to use this term, mentor, but there you go, John Calloway, who just died last year. I spoke at his funeral. God bless him, a wonderful man. Hired me, and that's, by the way, how I heard NPR, which I thought was the most wonderful kind of Chicago-style journalism I'd ever heard. It was direct, vivid, personal. It made a connection with people the way I think some of the great journalism of the Chicago Daily News in particular did. And that's what I wanted to be a part of. So I began to freelance for NPR, and they eventually offered me a job.
I heard you speak in Memphis many, many years ago, and you told a wonderful story about what I assume might be why your reporting and your writing distinguishes itself from many others with its humanity. And it was a story where you learned a little bit about about being more human and considering the people that you are covering. Do you know the story that I'm talking about?
Well, I don't know specifically what I might have said that night, because I can think of any number of instances in my life when I think I've been reminded of that, where, why it's so important to get things right is that you become aware of the fact that what I'm afraid in our business can seem like just another story is somebody's real life, and often you're covering something that is just about the most important thing that has ever happened to them. I mean, I remember covering the Civil War in El Salvador, and you would go to a village where there had been reports of a massacre, and you would interview people who had witnessed the army coming and departing, and were in a position to offer first-person testimony, and it was quite dangerous for them to talk to us. And of course, we would get what they say and leave town and probably never be back and do our stories and leave real-life consequences in their wake. I certainly thought about that when I covered the Siege of Sarajevo, which I later wound up writing a novel about, two teenage girls during the Siege of Sarajevo. But although I can make the argument, and I'll still make the argument now, that the entire civilized world had a stake in Sarajevo's survival, I couldn't pretend as if, I would come in to cover the siege and then ultimately leave, come in and then leave. I couldn't pretend as if the outcome of that civil war was material to what I could, in the foreseeable future of my own life. And yet, of course, it was absolutely the most important thing in the lives of the people who were there. And that I think should invest you with a sense of responsibility.
As the host of Weekend Edition Saturday, do you feel like you've grown and changed being a host instead of a reporter?
Well, I should explain. I still get out and do some reporting. I mean, I'm just back from doing some stories in this election season in a couple of states. And I do stories all the time. I mean, I went riding aboard the space shuttle simulator a few weeks ago in Houston. I am, alas, confirmed Chicago City kid that I am. I'm going out on another story where we're going bird watching with some experts at 6 a.m. in the morning, if I'm not mistaken. But I guess that's when the birds are hungry, and that's when you see them. So I still do a lot of what I consider to be reporting, one way or another. I do think, although inevitably, of course, you change over the years, and I think that's good. I mean, I have had such a rich professional and personal life. As I've said to people, it would be absolutely absurd for me to have had the rich professional and personal life I've had and wind up having the same ideas, attitudes, and convictions that I had 25 years ago. It would mean that I hadn't let real life in. It would mean that I hadn't been paying attention to what I'd been learning, seeing, and doing. So, yes, absolutely, I think I'm different.
And do your girls understand how cool it is what you do?
Well, I think they rather take it for granted at this particular point. I must say, worry every now and then about them being just a little bit jaded about these sorts of things. Because, by virtue, and I'm not sure virtue's exactly the word I mean, when, for example, we go to theater, there are often people who say, and why don't you come backstage and meet whoever is starring in it? And, our girls get very jaded about that because my wife was telling me that she took them to one of these little puppet theaters, I guess, to see a Halloween holiday show, and our girls expected to go back and meet the puppeteers.
But it always happens that way.
No, darlings, that's just with your father.
So you became an adopted father how many years ago now?
Let me see. Elise, who is 7, I guess almost 7 years ago, about 6 3/4 years ago.
And
she's our oldest, and we have a younger daughter, Lena, who turns 4 on November 2nd on Election Day.
Oh. And Did you know what you were in for when you embarked on the journey of adoption?
No, but I would add, Leanne, I don't think any parent knows what you're in for when you become a parent. I'm not sure it's entirely different. I think there are some specific and distinct things that you encounter adopting that maybe you don't when you have children and what my wife and I call the traditional method. But on the other hand, there are also traditional and distinct joys. I think one of the my wife and I have grown to feel that there really are some real advantages to adoption. And I just don't mean the obvious advantage of skipping my genetic line, which will give both of our daughters a much better chance in life, you know. But and then my wife jokes that one of the nice things about adoption is if you're an expectant mother who's adopting, you can actually have a glass of wine at night when you're expectant. But I think adoptive families are inspired. I used to say forced. I don't think it's forced at all. I think families who adopt are inspired to speak out loud to each other about how much they mean to each other, about how we fit together as a family, about what we need to go on and be a family together. That I think in traditional families, sometimes that stuff is assumed or unsaid. You know, of course I love you, you're my son. Yeah, Ma, of course I love you, you're my mother. I think in families that adopt, that are blessed by adoption, you're inspired to utter these things out loud and puzzle things out with each other. As my wife also says, there's no such thing as an accidental adoption. You know, you don't wake up one morning and say, oh, my God, I'm adopting. and I think that makes you sort of go through the process mentally and emotionally in advance, and it also keeps you paying attention during childhood, during every moment of your life.
What was the process like for you? I know other people who have adopted both domestically and foreign and from China, and sometimes that they have found the process full of anxiety and sometimes disappointment.
Absolutely. It's full of anxiety. It's full of disappointments. It's full of frustration. You fill out forms. You have interviews with social workers. Many of the forms that you fill out, for reasons I understand and respect, are valid for only a year. And so, therefore, if the adoption doesn't occur, isn't finalized within a year, you have to go through the process all over again, fill out the forms, make updates, more to the point, pay new fees. You begin to feel a little bit like a walking ATM machine. And, you know, it's the old story. You don't blanch at writing a check for a few thousand dollars if it's for an adoption. But then when they tell you they have to charge you $350 to photocopy a 7-page form, that's when you get, I am not, that sort of thing. And the anxiety, I think, anxiety is very difficult because you don't, I'm sure there's some exceptions in some adoption programs, and I'm happy for them, but you don't really, there's no timeline against which you can work or plan, with rare exceptions. I mean, in a sense, it's not like a pregnancy. All you know is you're approved, and then one day you wait for the phone call, or nowadays wait for the email. And I think those months, and sometimes as it was certainly in the case of our second daughter, over a year of waiting, we actually waited 2 years from the time that we were approved, you know, your mind plays tricks. You begin to fill in the blanks because things aren't happening. And your friends, while meaning only to be nice, are not always helpful because they'll come to you and say, what's going on with your adoption? And they'll go, well, everything's fine. We've been approved. We're just waiting to hear. And they'll go, well, what's wrong? And they'll say, well, nothing's wrong. We're just waiting to hear. And they go, you sure nothing's wrong? You sure nothing's wrong? And everybody has a friend who sat next to some guy who was flying the Hong Kong to Chicago route, and he said that the Chinese are doing this, the Chinese are doing that. And there are these listservs, chat groups, on the internet where everybody is passing along rumors, nobody has any solid information, and yet you crave something. You're hungry for information, and therefore you take in all the wrong kinds of information that, with retrospect, is nonsense. And that anxiety is very difficult. I mean, one of the worst days of our lives was when my wife and I were told of a given day that we were to stand by, you're going to hear from the adoption officials, and they're going to, you know, send you the email, pictures of your baby, we're going to get this underway. And that day came, and we were expecting to hear all day. I can't tell you how I jumped at the ping of an email, every email, and I get quite a few, and nothing happened. we didn't get word until 2 days later. And to this day, I don't know. Was it just nobody had plotted the time difference? That occurred to us later. Did somebody get the date wrong? We have no idea. But in any event, those were two very dreadful days.
You're listening to Focus on Illinois Public Media. I'm Leanne Donner, and my guest is Scott Simon. Scott, you've written this wonderful book, Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, and Praise of Adoption. I have to say that I found it wonderful and surprising, and I'm wondering if you knew going into it that you were going to structure it the way you did.
No, I didn't. Going into it, I mean, just to Random House had asked me to sketch out some thoughts, and it was, I think, overwhelmingly obviously drawn from our own personal experience. But my wife and I realized, even as I began to write that you know, we have only 6 years and change of personal experience. We are still at the rapturous stage of adoption. And, you know, I have been told, for example, that when youngsters become teenagers, demonic possession is very common. You know, they look, I mean, to be realistic, to speak like the part of me that is a journalist, too, I wouldn't want to write a whole book out of just what is a limited range of experience. But we had learned as adoptive parents that there's so many people you know in your circle of acquaintances who say, oh, you're adopting, I'm adopted. Oh, you're adopting, you know that kid you've known for 10 years, he's adopted. And we really welcomed the opportunity to talk to people who had been adopted, who had adopted, sometimes, as in the case of Jeff Seller, who's the Broadway theatrical producer. He grew up adopted by family in the Detroit area, and he and his partner Josh now have two children who are adopted. We just really welcome the opportunity to talk to a wide range of people about how adoption had blessed their lives and affected their lives, with no particular effort, I think, to make a point with each and every story, because I'm not sure you can, you know, I don't like to grade lives or grade adoptions as successful, unsuccessful, any of that stuff. But I, moreover, just vignettes that I think can help us share the human experience and let us form our own lessons. For example, Steve Levitt, the University of Chicago economics professor, most famous for Freakonomics, he and his wife, little boy, died, Andrew. I guess when he was almost exactly a year old, they have subsequently adopted two little girls. And Steve talks about, I think he's got some very pertinent things to say about the genius that young children have for not just absorbing and remembering and learning, but the genius that children have, particularly from orphanages and institutions, of forgetting what they don't need to go on. And kind of absorbing something and letting go of it and filling their lives with the future. And I think he's absolutely right about that.
How did you choose? I mean, obviously, Frank DeFord is someone that you know from National Public Radio. How did you choose the other stories that you tell in your book and weave in and among your own story?
You know, there was some thought that we should have a diversity of experiences. Frank and his wife, Carol, have adopted a young woman named Scarlett, who's now a jewelry designer in New York. But Steve Inskeep, my colleague at NPR and very good friend, Steve was adopted by Roland and Judy Inskeep of Carmel, Indiana. I mentioned Jeff Seller, who was adopted. Now he and his partner have adopted. Tabor McCallum. In Tucson, Arizona, was, as he said, on the verge of juvenile delinquency, and then he was adopted by rather informally. It had to be formalized later by a couple in Austin. Steven Segaler, who is a public broadcasting television official, he didn't know, I think, until he was fairly on in his childhood that he had been adopted. Stephen Segri, who is I have a lot of Steves in the book, I know we've noticed this. Stephen Segri, who was a jeweler and vintage watch seller, was part of a movement that we can forget about in the United States, where there were Italian orphans who were brought to the United States in the post-war era, whose families had disappeared died during World War II, and he and his brother Alphonse were actually brought to an orphanage. He is, I think, the one person in the book who grew up in an orphanage, in an institution. And your heart breaks while reading about it, because Steve grew up at Angel Guardian Orphanage right outside Chicago in Northwest Indiana, which was considered kind of a choate or groton, a prep school among orphanages. It had lots of financial support from many prominent Chicago mobsters, I must say, and Steve still talks about how opulent and splendid the Christmas parties were. But as my wife says, and I know I quote her a lot, but she's very wise, as my wife says, there are orphanages where there are enough food and enough clothing and enough heat for the youngsters, but there are no happy orphanages. And you understand how even in this place that was well provided for, the absence that Steve felt in his life, because he and his brother were not adopted, don't have a parent to not just look out for them, but identify with them for the rest of their lives. So I think we wanted to get a diversity of experiences, and it turned out, you know, that we knew a lot of people to whom we could approach. I mean, Thomas Lauderdale, who's head of the wonderful music group Pink Martini, a musical genius, one of four kids who were adopted by Kirby and Linda Lauderdale. And Thomas is, I guess we would say, visibly Asian, but he knows nothing of his background, says he doesn't really want to know anything of his background, because he finds it very consistent with being the artist that he is, to be what he calls this mystery Asian. And yet there are other people in the book, Martin Simon, the son of the late Paul Simon, our great senator from our home state of Illinois.
And what an interesting story that is with the...
Pardon me?
I said, what an interesting story that is with the...
It's extraordinary, because it said on his birth certificate that he was Native American, and Martin grew up believing that he was Cherokee. And he was 28 and met his birth mother, Nikki. And as he said to me, she looked about as American Indian as the as Diana, Princess of Wales. And he said to her, how are we? And, you know, Paul Simon became, I believe, the chairman of the Senate Subcommittee on Indian American Affairs, on Native American Affairs. And Martin said, he said to his birth mother, Nikki, how are we, you know, Indian? And she said, Indian? He said, yeah, in my birth certificate it says Native American. And she said, oh, they asked me what we were, and I said, we're all American. as Martin says, you know, he'd already gone to all those powwows. Turns out that he was Swedish. And I love that story, I must say, Leanne, for a few reasons. And one of them is, and I don't mind saying this if I may speak Illinoisan to Illinoisan, I know, having covered a lot of politicians, it is rare to encounter a public figure in politics who looks even better in private than he or she does in public. Paul Simon, who looked pretty good in public, was that rare man. This was a man of real character. And I'm glad that story's in there for that reason. But also it shows you how absolutely amorphous and fungible and misleading ethnic identity can be, or deriving your identity from your ethnicity. Because here, you know, Martin had grown up believing he had a certain identity, and it turned out to be something else entirely. But on the other hand, who would say that, you know, that what he learned about Native American culture, or the identity that he felt with Native Americans, was wrong or impertinent or somehow wasted time and effort? Because he doesn't feel that way, and I think he's absolutely right. And this is something that is on our minds, my wife and I, because, of course, our two little girls are Chinese. And on the one hand, we want them to know about their native culture. We want to be able to have them study it, learn about it, and respect it. On the other hand, you know, we also know we've adopted two real little girls, not vessel of a culture. And we want them to be open to the changes that life can bring.
You did a great job of choosing stories that are each different from another. And one of my favorites is the story of Chris Leonard. Some of the stories are happy, and some of them are not happy. But his is a very happy story.
Chris is lived in North Carolina, where he's in the furniture business, and he was pushing 40 when and had known he'd been adopted, and he was pushing 40 when he was initially contacted by an attorney. Who represented his birth mother. And he met his birth mother, and there's just a wonderful story where he says to his parents who raised him, you know, I've got this beautiful letter from my birth mother who says I was always loved. She gave me up because she thought it was the best thing for me, but she always loved me, and she wanted me to know that, wants me to know that, and she'd like to meet me. Is that okay with you? And he said that his parents read that letter and said, well, son, we've had you to ourselves for just about 40 years. I think we can share you with someone now. And he met his birth mother, and getting to know and love his birth mother, she at one point showed him a picture of a man, very good-looking, stylish, dapper man, and said, that's your birth father. And Chris thought that, you know, thought he certainly looked like a celebrity, and then discovered that he was Alexander Julian, the fashion designer. This being a small world, my wife and I know and love Alex Julian and his wife Megan. We were married at their home in Colorado, or their home in Connecticut. And they've got a few. We were married at the Connecticut one. Maybe we'll renew our vows at the Colorado one. But in any event, and he didn't want to contact Alexander Julian at first. And then he was at a furniture convention in Las Vegas, and Alex makes a line of furniture, and he saw Alex from a distance. And he said something was set off. This man who he had not only no interest in meeting, this man who he kind of vaguely resented for having run out on his birth mother, or that's what he felt. Alex has obviously a different side of the story, but as Chris says, he wants to be a son. He doesn't want to be some kind of judge. He felt this urge to contact Alex. So he walked around, tried to find him again, didn't want to come up to him in public because didn't know if anybody else knew this. But a couple days later, he was able to find him in Connecticut, called him, and he said, look, Mr. Julian, I know who you are. I don't want anything from you except to meet you. I'm not after anything. I have a wonderful life. I certainly don't want any money from you. I am your birth son. You are my father, and I would like to meet you if that's all right. And Alex said, this was over the phone, of course. Alex said, I have tears running down my face. What do you think that means? And they met and have become very close. And it is just such a tribute to everyone involved, both the way Alex and Megan opened their lives and their hearts to include Chris and his family, the way Chris's birth mother opened her life and her heart to include everybody, the way the parents who raised Chris have opened their lives and heart. And I must say, Alex Julian, our friend, is the first one to say that he is mostly grateful to Chris's parents because they raised a young man who was full of love and full of understanding. And that doesn't happen by accident.
Very impressive about this is the consideration that he showed for his parents, for the birth mother, and then for this man that he did not have very positive feelings about in the beginning.
Yeah, well, Chris is an exceptional human being, absolutely an exceptional human being, and I believe that's the last vignette that we impart in the book. And I must say there's a reason for that. It was unconscious at the time. But I think it's there, and it deserves to be there, because it kind of puts the capper on the whole experience of adoption. And I think that is among the many things that I think adoption can instruct families about, is to lead with your heart, to keep your heart open, to not draw arbitrary boundaries. Because I think one thing you learn from adoption, of course, is that blood, genes, you know, that doesn't count, really, for much of anything. It's shared experience. It's belonging to each other. It's steering through life together. That's what counts. That's what keeps us together. And I think every parent, you know, Leanne, has to contend with the fact that our love for our children is not exclusive. You know, at some point, if we raise our children right, they will rebel and push back. And in the case of our daughters, I'm sure one day they will say, why did you take us out of the world's fastest expanding economy and bring us to this industrial backwater? And at one point they leave us and go out and fall in love with other people. And this is true of all families. I think adoptive families come to terms a little earlier with the fact that other people who almost certainly love our children as much as we do gave birth to them. but for one reason or another couldn't keep them. And you become aware of the fact that love really is a property that expands the human heart to encompass more people and more feeling.
With the Chris Leonard story, did you learn about that because of your friendship with Alex?
Yes, absolutely we did.
So each one of these stories is a story that you know through a personal connection.
All of these stories in here are stories that we knew through a personal connection, and it really happened when we adopted, and people would say, oh, you know, we have our own adoption story. Chris we had known about because Megan called us up one day and said, well, you'll never guess who's coming for lunch. And, you know, that has worked out so happily, by the way. And I say this in the book, so I don't mind saying this on your program, Leanne, but, I mean, this has worked out so happily between Chris Leonard and his wife Karen and his parents and Alex and Megan Julian. It's worked out so happily that Megan, Alex's wife, had to sit down their two teenage boys and say, look, I really cherish how much Chris means to us, and I think this is great and this is just wonderful, but because I think Alex was 19 when he sired Chris, and she said, I'm just so happy this all worked out so well, but I don't want you two kids to think for a moment this is the way you start families. You are too young to have families, and this worked out because of a lot of blessed people who worked it out so gracefully, but this is not the way to begin your family.
There are a lot of books available on adoption and a lot of pitfalls that your book could have fallen into. It could have been sappy. It could have been preachy. It could have been very technical and dry, but you did a wonderful job of making it very poignant without being sappy and getting important information across without being dry and getting your opinion across without being preachy. Was that a conscious effort, or is that just the way you write?
Well, I hope it's a little bit of both. I mean, I've often figured out that because this is my fifth book, that, you know, I want to write books that I would like to read. And I don't like books that are dense and hard packed for all the wrong reasons. And I certainly don't like books that are preachy. And I also, it was important for me from the beginning that people understand this as, if I may, not just an adoption book. I think of this as a book of love stories. The love story of our family, certainly, but the love stories of a dozen other families. A book of romances, of how people meet and fall in love and begin to steer their courses in life with each other. And I think that's the only thing that will keep people flipping over the pages, you know. The challenges are there, and that's good in narrative because we absolutely wonder how we're going to meet them and what the result is going to be. But I think also, you know, the rough stuff is also in there because there can be challenges in any family, and some of them I think are sometimes distinct to adoption. And I think that's all part of it too. And I think in the end, it makes you love and cherish each other all the more.
If I'm recalling correctly, you take issue with using the word parenting as a verb.
I do, and maybe I'm being small-minded about that. I'm not certain when that started. I certainly hear it every day, if not every hour nowadays, and I just don't like it. It's as simple as that. You know, I have no moral problem with it. I just don't like turning words into verbs like that.
Something that I had not really read about much until I read your book is that the primal wound theory, and I guess I'd never heard it called that before, but you sort of introduce it and talk about it, but you don't really embrace it.
Don't really embrace it, although I have great respect for Nancy Verrier, the family therapist in the Bay Area, who wrote a book called The Primal Wound, which is considered, I think, one of the absolutely seminal documents in adoption literature. And not just that book, but I think Nancy's work has made a profound and, I think, positive difference in the lives of so many people who've been adopted. And I can all I can do is take off my hat with respect to that. And Nancy is, by the way, the parent of two youngsters who were adopted herself. And I just have a problem with it being called the primal wound, because it, and some problem with the theory, in that it suggests to me that adoption is some kind of trauma, which you have to get over, and there may always be some lingering sensitivity. I think of adoption as a blessing. I think we're all going to have, as we go out throughout our lives, we're all going to have traumas, things that are to get over, and no doubt about it. You know, it's a rough way to begin life. You know, and I at one point I dismiss it a bit by saying that I think I suffered a primal wound when I wasn't born Warren Buffett's son. You know, respecting, I think, more than the book, respecting the work that Nancy has done, I absolutely agree that it's a tough way to begin life, and it takes some extra special attention. And I write in the book that sometimes for youngsters who have had their most formative months, after all, in institutions where that mother-child bond has been broken, so they're not, you know, they're not held when they cry, they're not fed when they're hungry, but according to a schedule, obviously that can have some lingering effects. And I don't, you know, one of them can be, hunger can be a trigger. So even, you know, the youngsters from that kind of background can go through a stage where when they become hungry, you know, even if logically they know that they've got four flavors of premium ice cream and bagels and hummus and pita chips and baby carrot sticks and celery and 50 different kinds of yogurt and all that stuff in the refrigerator, hunger can still be a trigger that makes them cry because they become, literally their insides clench for food because they're not, it's a trigger. They're not accustomed to being fed when they're hungry, but fed according to a schedule. And, you know, and sometimes their behavior can become affected. And it's just you, you know, you go through it and eventually love and food, but it can take a while. And I absolutely recognize that. But I don't like the idea of using adoption as some kind of trauma or some kind of crutch, because it seems to me that it is mostly a blessing. And as Jeff Seller, the Broadway producer, who I write about in the book, who is adopted, in addition to he and his partner Josh having children who are adopted. As Jeff says, look, life is a process of going up and losing and falling down and putting the Band-Aid over the bruise and getting up and going on and becoming stronger because of it. You know, he says we fall down, we, you know, we get scarred, we become stronger, we lose all kinds of things along the way. People we love die. We lose our teeth. Some of us lose our hair, although I seem to be doing reasonably well there. He said, if you want to make being adopted the one trauma in your life you will never get over, you can do that. But why would you want to do that? Because this is the only life, so far as we know, that you're ever going to have. And on the contrary, why not view being adopted as a blessing rather than viewing the fact that you know, something happened to the relationship between you and your birth mother as some kind of curse that you have to, a sting that you have to carry for the rest of your life.
Today, when people decide that they want to adopt, there are a lot of resources available. There are workshops and there's a lot of literature, both in print and on the internet. Do you think that today's parents who adopt are better prepared than parents of generations ago who adopted, you know, a child from an orphanage in what is a more, what used to be the traditional way? Now there are not really many orphanages in this country, the way that we see them in the movies now. But they did not have these kinds of resources. Do you think that makes a big difference?
Yes, I think it does, and I hope it does, which is not in any way, because I think, obviously, a lot of families did just fine, including Paul and Jean Simon, and, you know, they didn't have nearly the kind of resources when Martin came into their lives that are available now. There's information on the web, there are workshops, there are so many books that are out there. I think there's every reason for parents to be better prepared. I want to say, though, in the next breath, Leanne, you also need to be a parent. And my wife and I have discovered when we have made, I don't want to say mistakes, because everybody makes mistakes as a parent. But when my wife and I have done something as parents that we, in retrospect, think maybe wasn't a wise idea, it's often because we were following instructions in a book. And I'm afraid children do not come with instruction manuals. And, you know, you can't buy a book that will, I mean, it'll give you some good ideas, but in the end, you have to use what Hemingway called your own built-in fireproof, you know, I can't quote exactly what he called it, the blank detector. And you know, you have to have your own judgment. You have to have your heart open. You have to have your mind sharp. You have to have, you keep your vision clear. And you have to make decisions that are relevant to your child and your family. And you can't be run around by a book, including mine.
How early did you start talking to your girls about that they were adopted?
Well, Elise was 11 months old and Lena was 7 months old when they came into our lives. And, we've never talked in any other way. I mean, I think, I mean, my gosh, our little girls are from China, so it's not as if we could wait until they were 13.
Right.
And set them down and say, honey, you may have noticed that Mama and Daddy don't look exactly like you do. So it's always been very natural. We've talked about it from the first. And, of course, Elise, our oldest little girl, went through a delightful period where she assumed everybody was adopted. And she even asked us if our cat, Fiona, she calls Nana, who we call Nana now, too, she even asked us if Nana was a baby cat in China. She said, by the way, that she, you know, that she would, she, when she grows up, would like to adopt. But she said, you know, China's too far to go. I think I'll just go to Chicago. So they've both gone through periods where they think adoption is just the natural order of the world. And I think I say in the book, if there's nothing else that my book does, I hope it's to convince people that it is, one way or another, the natural order of the world. I mean, now they know that there are other ways to have families, gosh knows, not just adoption. But I do believe that adoption, I actually, you know, not to impeach my credibility as a journalist, I actually did a little research, Leanne, as opposed to just forming my conclusions and then finding the research to fit. And if you read about the history of adoption, you know, it's just about as old as childbirth, as Abraham and style begetting. It didn't begin with Moses, that's for sure, although it's instructive to read the story of Moses because, of course, when Pharaoh's daughter lowered her arms down to the bulrushes and picked up this baby, he was wrapped in a Hebrew blanket. She didn't think this was a member of the Egyptian royal family, but she took her into her, took that baby into her life and raised him as a member of the Egyptian royal family. And this has been going on for centuries, since, as we say, time immemorial. You read ancient accounts, and there'd be these blistering, terrible battles. And warriors would walk over the smoldered, choking battlefield, smoky with embers and ruins, and little babies would be left in the embers, babies, after all, that had been born to their enemies, and they would pick them up and raise them as their own. I think it is something that we are wired to do as a species. And that's not a medical opinion, but I think it's historically defensible. I think there is something in us that is wired to take care of children in need. And adoption has been going on almost as long as childbirth. And by the way, I mean, I run the obvious suspects. We have to, because we've just observed John Lennon's 70th birthday. John Lennon, of course, was adopted. Steve Jobs, of course, adopted. Tolstoy, Moses, and I don't even, as I say in the book, I don't even have to mention Jesus Christ to make my point.
You worry about how society will treat your girls or certain not very enlightened members of society that they might encounter. And I love your scenario, your preferred scenario for the day that someone says something about your daughter not being white. And her response to that and the situation. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think any parent has got to be worried about a time when their you know, the youngster's ethnicity might be remarked upon or ridiculed or mocked. You know, and I know that children are as scheming as Stasi agents. I mean, they, you know, they use whatever is around, and it is absolutely on my mind that somebody might kid our youngsters or even mock or ridicule our youngsters for being Chinese, and our daughters are perfectly capable of saying, oh, yeah, well, you're fat, or you have curly hair, which, you know, which also isn't distinguished. But, you know, I mean, I don't know how I'll handle that. Let's put it that way. And there have been a few borderline cases, and I don't react well. But nothing, look, this is America. We are absolutely to my mind, a very successful multiracial society, which doesn't mean that we don't have our problems. But, you know, my mother was an Irish immigrant and had to, when she came to Chicago, there were no Irish need apply signs that were up in Chicago. And certainly the Irish have done well in Chicago. And probably, Leanne, not a week goes by that I don't get an anti-Semitic email. So I know there's still anti-Semitism in this country, and yet it would be hard for me to argue with a straight face that I've been some kind of victim of anti-Semitism. So I write in the book that I do hope that, you know, when that day comes in the coarsest manner, I hope it's on the soccer field so that our little girls can kick a goal and turn around and say to their tormentor, and you know what, buddy? I'm Jewish, too.
So are you raising your girls Jewish?
Well, we're raising them with an exposure to several different faiths. Judaism, my wife is Catholic, but, you know, and we've certainly have friends who are, in fact, clergy, and we have brought them to Catholic services, too. And, you know, we will bring them to others. I mean, one of our little girls is in a school that's on the grounds of an Episcopal church, so we're going to go to, and we have been to already, a couple of Episcopal services. I think we want to, we're a multi-faith, multi-ethnic household, and I think we want to expose them to everything. I think they identify themselves as being a Jewish family now. And our little girls thinks that, you know, that's really neat because you get some holidays that the rest of the kids in school don't get.
Presents.
And you also, of course, get 8 presents during Hanukkah. And then when Hanukkah's over, they can look forward to Christmas, too.
And will they get bat mitzvahs?
You know, that's not up to me.
It's up to them?
They will be, you know, they will decide whatever they want to do. And, I don't know. I mean, it can be whatever they want. And I think the fact that they'll make their own decision and we will live by it is going to be a sign that maybe my wife and I have done well by them. I hope so. You know, because it is never lost on us, Leanne, that the blessing that our daughters are in our lives begin with a tragedy. And that tragedy is the young mothers, because we have 2 daughters in China who couldn't keep their babies. And I cannot imagine the pain and the torment that those 2 young mothers went through. They had to be very courageous to bear their children, to hide from authorities, bear their children, and then put them in a place where they knew that they would be found and hoped and prayed that they would have better lives. And that's a tragedy and even a human rights crime. And my wife and I never get too far, too deep into the week without remembering that our blessing began with the tragedy in the lives of 2 young women in China. And we are just determined to give our daughters lives that will justify the sacrifices that their birth mothers made.
Well, following you on Facebook and listening to you on Saturday mornings, it's so obvious that you are the most loving father and so in love with your wife and both your daughters. And it's real inspiration to listeners and Facebook followers. And your book is really wonderful, whether or not you have, whether or not you're thinking about adopting or you know someone who's adopted. If you thought you were never interested in adoption at all, you would still find this book just really touching. And you'll think about adoption more seriously, and you'll look around the world and just see it as a different place. Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other, In Praise of Adoption by Scott Simon, who is also, of course, the host of Weekend Edition Saturday on National Public Radio. Scott, thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much, Leanne. Thanks so much.